Hello, this is Ethan Nadelman. I'm the Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance, and I want to welcome all of you who are online with us today to our web chat. We've done a number of these in the past with Ira Glasser, the head of the American Civil Liberties Union, who now chairs the Drug Policy Alliance, with some of my colleagues, with Eric Schlosser, and I'm absolutely delighted to have as our guest today two dear friends, two remarkable human beings, Sasha and Ann Shulgin. I mean, really, the outstanding pioneers in psychedelic research for so many years. They were just recently featured in the New York Times Magazine. Sasha has been an amazing explorer and pharmacologist and chemist, and Anne has been a beautiful writer and therapist. And they've been, I'm very glad to have them on our show today. So welcome, Sasha. Welcome, Anne.
Hi. Hello.
Yeah, and I remember we had you in New York for a live engagement a few months ago, and there was a wonderful crowd of about 100, 200 people there, including lots of young people who just really revered the way that you were pursuing your work and pursuing your research and such. So, you know, we've already received, before this chat, a whole series of questions that people have thrown at you and that people would like to ask. Some of these questions started off with ecstasy. And let me just pick one of the most interesting ones. You know, obviously, a lot of people listening have had extensive experience with ecstasy. One of the questions was, what's your sense of how ecstasy has evolved and emerged in American society since you essentially, you know, didn't invent it, but discovered its entheogenic uses?
Do you want to take that one?
I'll take it, yes. It has evolved, it has grown in use, and I think the growth in use, and it's the way it is being used, and it's, of course, being made a Schedule I illegal material, has probably robbed the medical society of one of the most valuable potential therapeutic tools in psychotherapy. It cannot be used in psychotherapy now because of its illegality, and this I saw as being the primary value of the material. So I believe this growth of use and the growth of illegality has, to a measure, robbed the medical community of a very valuable tool.
Right. Although there are some studies underway now. Isn't there something going on in South Carolina and something at Harvard? I mean, what can you tell us about those?
Let's see. As Sasha, you told me there's one MDMA-assisted psychotherapy in subjects with chronic treatment-resistant, whatever that means.
Well, actually, the MDMA is being a study. It's either been set up, being underway, or it's been completed in the use of MDMA in the treatment of anxiety associated with cancer, terminal cancer.
Oh, mm-hmm. That's not the PTSD.
That's the one that's being set up at Harvard.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And then another one is the use of psilocybin in that same general thing where it's been used in a study, again, with anxiety associated with terminal cancer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, I guess there's the South Carolina study, right, that Michael and Ann Mithoffer are doing, and that's the PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome.
That's right, and that's a MAP-sponsored program in South Carolina.
That's right. It's been sponsored by the organization that was founded by Rick Doblin called MAPS. It's MAPS.org. It's a multidisciplinary association of psychedelic studies. You know, there was a wonderful little article just recently in the German magazine Der Spiegel called Ecstasy on the Battlefield, and they go, the U.S. government has found a new way of recruiting soldiers for the Iraq War. It's offering them ecstasy.
Oh.
Now, of course, what that's about is that I believe the government has approved allowing some people to enter the South Carolina study for treatment of their PTSD.
I believe in the South Carolina study that some 5 out of the 20 subjects have already completed the study.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't realize they're actually using that as an inducement to.
My guess, Ann, is that the magazine Der Spiegel was spoofing the whole thing a bit, you know. But it is interesting that, you know, there does appear, I mean, to be a slight green light moving forward for some research in this area. I mean, why do you think the government's finally gone along? I mean, clearly the persistence of Rick Doblin and MAPS has played a pivotal role in moving things forward. I mean, what else do you think's happening there?
Well, I track it back, though I may or may not be right, to the change in the media. There were years of melodramatic nonsense, mostly, about ecstasy, which, by the way, we really hate using the word, because ecstasy can be anything at all. What we use is MDMA. And there was a change when a young reporter, whose name escapes me at the moment, wrote a very good article for Time magazine.
John Cloud, I think that
John
was.
John Cloud, yes. Yes. And that was very good. It emphasized the psychotherapy aspect of the use of MDMA, and this had been something that mostly the television programs had completely overlooked or just barely mentioned.
Yeah.
I think that since John Cloud came out with that, there was a little ripple through the journalistic community, and I think the message was it's time to change the message.
Mm-hmm.
And it started to change.
Mm-hmm.
People were a little more willing to, I think Peter Jennings came along with a very good special after that.
Well, I remember, Ann, that Jennings was working on that special, and then that thing popped up where the leading sort of anti-ecstasy researcher, anti-MDMA researcher, Ricarte from Hopkins, and it turned out that he had done this study where he had accidentally given some animals amphetamine instead of MDMA, and then science remarkably published his study, even though it was inconsistent with all the pre-existing studies. And I think when that mistake was revealed, my guess is that must have helped push the pendulum back the other way as well.
I think you're right, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a very, very sad thing for Dr. Ricarte, but I think it did help to make people think twice.
You know what else I remember? I remember the three of us being at a gathering 10 years ago, I guess, about a whole week-long gathering about the issue of psychedelics. And one of the things that was interesting was that some of the people who were at this gathering and who were sympathetic to the psychedelics research are really quite well known for their support for the drug war. I mean, I won't mention any names, but some very prominent people who had previously served in the drug czar's office and were identified with very repressive policies. Nonetheless, you could see that in their younger days, they were aware of the research on LSD and other psychedelics going back to the 50s and early 60s, and they actually thought that there was, that there was stuff worth investigating there.
Sure. Yeah.
You know,
but
I mean,
what happens to the politicians is that they wait until they're out of office, and they're not planning to go back into office, and then they open up and say what they really feel and think.
Yeah.
But by that time, it's a bit late.
I mean, Sasha, what have you found? I mean, in terms of the more kind of quote-unquote mainstream biochemist and, you know, pharmacological community, do you find a kind of, are there a lot of closet interest in this or people who are aware of the old research? You know, what's your sense of that?
In the academic world, there are a surprisingly large number of people who are quite fascinated with the area and are appropriately afraid of the area. They're mm-hmm. fascinated because they do read things, they do hear other people speak about experiences that they find to be quite intriguing, and yet they're in an academic position of accepting grants from NIDA and from the government and from this and that, who would not either tolerate a study of this, in this area, or would be very patient with a person who was publicly speaking positively about it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a great deal of politics that influences the academic world.
Yeah. You know, one of the questions that came in from, there's one question from Darren Buss, another one from Michael Ruderman, and they're essentially asking, what about for younger people who are interested in doing psychedelics research? Is there a way to do it? Is there a future in this? How would you propose that they proceed?
Yeah.
Well, I think when I get this occasionally get this question from others, what can I do academically to get in the situation of doing this kind of research? And to me, the answer I always say is get yourself a college education, get yourself an advanced degree, preferably a PhD, in some area, biochemistry, chemistry, physiology, some area that can touch upon this area of research, and then take a postdoctorate study with someone to teach you the rules of research, not what you're looking at, but how you look at things. And with that background, then you can begin getting an academic position of your own and begin calling your own shot for your own research.
Are there any researchers around the country at the universities who stand out as being people who could mentor and advise these students?
Oh, there are researchers who are working in the area of psychedelic drugs, but not with human subjects.
Mm-hmm.
David Nichols at Purdue has been one of the most creative person, and there are many graduate students who have gone through his studies there,
right,
and have gone on in their own research.
Rick Strassman,
Charlie Grobe at UCLA.
Grobe down in Southern California.
And then is it John Halpern at Harvard?
Is it Harvard? Same role.
All three of those are psychiatrists. That's a good place to start.
Now, that's a medical degree, but at least get an academic degree in something that is in that scientific area.
Now, there's a bunch of questions here about ecstasy, because obviously millions and millions of Americans, have used these, and no doubt many of our listeners are familiar with it. Let me just throw a few of these questions at you. The first one is, why do you think music seems to play such a large role in the MDMA experience? Is there what's this connection with the rave culture? Is there any connection about the brain's response to music in MDMA?
Well, my thought is that music is absolutely magical under the influence of any psychedelic I can think of. Even to people who don't listen to music that much, listening. Of course, we prefer classical, the modern Russians, but listening to any music under the influence of these materials. Is a tremendously rich experience.
Right, so it's not just ecstasy, it's mushrooms, and it can be LSD and a whole range of things.
But one of the things with ecstasy, with MDMA, is that it does tend to drop your barriers a little bit. That's why it's so good in psychiatry, in psychopharmacology, in therapeutic work. You don't take a year to get a communication through your barriers to your physician.
Mm-hmm.
The barriers are dropped almost immediately, and music is, of course, in the rave scene, is interactions and dropping of the barriers makes the interaction much more smooth, and of course the music is much more part of the world.
Right. Well, now here's another question, which is a number of people have asked this. They say, I've used ecstasy or MDMA literally hundreds of times, lost count how many times I've used it, and I'm worried. I want to know. I see all this stuff out there. Is this going to cause any harm to me as I get older? Should I stop using it now? Do I have anything to worry about my children being affected? What's the current state of knowledge? This stuff we see about the occasional death, whether it's in the Bay Area or in England or wherever it might be, are these really, MDMA overdose deaths?
I personally don't believe there is a reputable threat of physical, psychological damage from MDMA on the large scale. There are individual idiosyncratic sensitivities, certainly.
But they're very rare.
Another thing that is often brought up is the neural damage or the serotonin receptor site damages. This has been shown in animals, but it's not been shown in man. Another point to bear out is the fact that many times the death associated with MDMA was the tripping at the top of a staircase and falling downstairs.
Mm-hmm.
And the because there was MDMA in the body, the MDMA is the cause of death in the autopsy.
Mm-hmm.
So these,
or sometimes some young person who's not really very bright has taken MDMA along with three or four other drugs, and for some reason the media picks on the MDMA.
Another point also is the fact that with hundreds of uses, many uses, sometimes some people, not that many, the original magic of MDMA is lost.
Mm-hmm.
And people then tend to use more of it, trying to recapture the magic, and it is just about not recapturable.
And it is not. There's nothing that one can do to recapture the magic, essentially.
I don't know of it, no.
Well, there is actually something you can do, and that is, I know personally of one psychologist out here, and there must be others in the country, who specialize, or at least half of their practice is in taking in people, clients who have had the MDMA experience and loved it and want to recapture it, and under hypnosis they find out how to do that so that they don't have to take a chance with drugs that may or may not have any MDMA in them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much safer legally, and this seems to have been very successful.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's a question from John Ubersax. He says, are there any legal substances that produce experiences similar or comparable to those of MDMA?
I'd be hesitant to give answers to a question like that, because if you do, if I were to say, yes, such and such is very much like MDMA, this could be immediately promoted into a crashing drive to synthesize, to sell, and I think it would be not to the community's advantage.
Okay. Now, for those of you who have recently tuned in, this is Ethan Nadelman. I'm the Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance. We're the leading organization in the U.S. and probably the world of people who believe that the war on drugs is doing more harm than good. We're a membership organization, and we depend upon contributions from all of you. So if you're not yet a member of the Drug Policy Alliance, please do hit that donate button on the DPA webpage there. Now, if you want to ask a question, what you can do is you just type it in on the bottom right of the auditorium page on the web page there. I am here chatting with Sasha and Ann Shulgin, the noted psychedelic researchers and chemists and therapists. And this next question is for you. The question really is, if you think back about all the sorts of therapeutic types of encounters and sessions you've done with people with where MDMA has played a role, are there any sorts of things that sort of stand out as breakthroughs or as really remarkable sessions in your recollection?
Yes, there are several. It's a little bit difficult to summarize sessions which may have taken 6 months to a year, but the one of the most startling one was with a gentleman who was having trouble with his legs, and he couldn't understand why he seemed to always have something happen to his legs. He had a small airplane crash, and the only thing hurt, though it was temporary, were his legs, etc. All this sort of thing went on, and he wondered if there's any way to find out why. And also, when he got into an airplane, he would have a great unease in his legs. So he had an MDMA session, which this is obviously before it was illegalized, and suddenly remembered that he had been, I think, 5 or 6 years old, and the elementary school he was in, there was, I don't know what it was, whether it was snow or some other weight on the ceiling, but the entire ceiling crashed in. And he sort of came to, standing in line with his little friends, with the teacher trying to keep everybody from being too panicked. And the only thing he could remember at that time was that his legs had been caught under the edge of his desk. And the entire trauma concentrated on his legs, even more so because when he got home, his family insisted that his mother insisted that nobody discuss this awful event. Put it out of your minds, and let's go on with our life. Of course, that sort of repression is the worst sort of thing you could do. So this was the first time he'd remembered this event was under MDMA, which opened up the entire memory.
And, you know, it sounds a lot when you talk about this. I mean, you hear sometimes similar experiences happening in very intense psychotherapy or body work or rolfing or holotropic breathing or sometimes other types of spiritual. I mean, what it sounds like in a way is that ecstasy or MDMA is one among a variety of tools that can help people get there, and perhaps it's oftentimes is a faster and easier way to get people there if they're able to do so responsibly.
Yeah, and what we found, the hypnotherapist I worked with for a couple of years, is that hypnotherapy works very well with the addition of MDMA. But when people ask me what can take the place of MDMA, one of the other answers is hypnotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
That also unlocks the same doors
mm-hmm.
that MDMA unlocks, one of those doors being to early memories.
Now, you know, I mean, you know, obviously back in the 50s, early 60s, there was all this research with psychedelics and psychotherapy and in dealing with, I mean, there were those famous studies dealing with prisoners and dealing with people suffering from alcoholism and a whole range of other things. And when you think, when you look at MDMA and compare it with, what was it, mescaline and other substances were used at, back then, what are or were the advantages and disadvantages of each of these?
Well, many of them had very, very strong advantages, primarily for the reason that Anne was saying, that they open up things that had been blocked because of mental worries or because of self-images. And these become available to think about, to use in your own world. On the other hand, this can occur with many psychedelics. The psychedelics present often a visual or a tactile or an auditory world that would tend to keep you from going into a therapeutic world, to a therapeutic study. Whereas MDMA has the advantage of not giving you much in the way of visual effects out there, but primarily one of warmth and of opening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the MDMA is not a psychedelic. Although the visual interpretations and visual changes, it can be quite nice, but it is really not a psychedelic at all. So, as Sasha says, you aren't taken out of your focus by a lot of fancy things happening on the walls.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it also, I mean, it has this reputation for having this sort of loving quality about it, this heart-opening and pathogenic. I remember when I was doing the interview with the Peter Jennings show, although he didn't use this on his show, and, you know, he asked, well, what's it like? And I said, well, the thing you say about MDMA, especially the first time you take it, is that it makes you feel warmly towards strangers, lovingly towards friends, and profoundly in love with your lover. And it puts people in a place where they feel able to both hear and say things that normally all their defenses would go up against. And I think when, you know, with the psychedelics, those oftentimes are more powerful. I remember when people talked about doing these things and using these in psychotherapy, sometimes they would talk about using them in a low-dose form, sort of like MDMA has been used in psychotherapy.
Opening the door a little bit, but not letting the
right
run through it.
And then other times they would talk about giving the heavy dose to really knock people back and try to really create a profound alteration of consciousness and awareness.
Well, there's one thing that MDMA does particularly well and probably better than any other drug I know of, and that is that it allows you to really love and accept yourself, which is, after all, the basis for the loving of anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is it allows you to see all your faults and all your problems, but also that you are a treasure. And that this particular part of the MDMA experience is what liberates people who have been very closed in and are fighting self-hatred. So MDMA is still the exceptional drug for this kind of experience.
That can have a negative side, though, Anna. I had a very good friend, he's now dead, who very much wanted to try MDMA. But he had two properties. One, he was an alcoholic. He'd close the bar up every night, helping other people in their problems. But the second one, he thoroughly and totally disliked homosexuals.
Oh, yeah.
And I wondered if possibly, if he would have MDMA and open this realization, the doors of his own background, he might have a fear that he is a homosexual.
Yeah.
And that would, to me, that discouraged my even encouraging his using the MDMA.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Yeah, that's the point. But still, you know, I have to say that in all the therapy work I did as a lay therapist, I have to say, that this one particular experience of self-acceptance turned out to be the most valuable part. of the experience.
And you know, the thing I also wondered about is, you know, how much these moments with MDMA sort of are fleeting. You know, there's this self-awareness, there's maybe some resonance that lasts for a few days or weeks or even months, but then people basically go back to being who they're being. Whereas for some people, they seem to find to use this as an opportunity to really make some substantive and desirable change in their life.
Yeah.
You know, maybe, and I wonder if you have any clues or tips for people about, you know, are there ways, since, you know, as you've said, you know, once you use MDMA enough, it basically stops working for you, or you dramatically diminish the positive effect. What are the ways in which one can make the most of that limited number of sessions where you really do derive the tremendous insights?
Well, you have to have the desire to continue going and spiritually growing. And if you don't, if you're just using any drug, no matter how good the drug, and I'm talking about psychedelics now, if you just want to have a turn on, or, you know, go to a dance party and nothing else, then eventually the psychedelic experience is going to feel hollow.
Well, actually, in your case there, the psychedelic experience could actually be not an opening, but it could be a turnoff of the world, escape from the world around you. And some people, I'm sure, use the dancing just to be able to close off the day's work and the weekend's problems.
Yeah. In fact, it seems like some of the scariest use patterns have happened in that scene where you have young people who do an MDMA, and all of a sudden they feel, you know, their fears, their insecurities are lifted, they feel good, they feel positive, they feel wonderful, they feel accepted, and then they use it weekend after weekend, and they find it's not working quite as well, and so they start increasing the dose and using it with more and more frequency. And I guess that's the thing that most worries lots of people, both people who have been through this type of use pattern, as well as their parents and everybody else, that you're getting young people who, while still in their teens, are using these things, you know, not just on the 100, 150 milligram level, but are doing, you know, 300, 400, 500 milligrams at a night, and doing it not just every few months, but weekly.
Yeah. And complicating things by often adding other drugs, so you're not on a single drug, but you're on a multiple drug situation, which is new territory.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the things that helps avoid that sort of thing is, first of all, do not take any consciousness expanding drug, whether it's MDMA or anything else, too often. It should be a very important experience which you think about for weeks and months, and try to assimilate, to learn from what happened. And if you had insights, then think about them, write them down, and work on them. In other words, try and change patterns which you saw to be negative. And that way you grow with the insight. But insight itself is tremendously important.
Mm-hmm.
It just means looking in without negative judgment, but looking into yourself to see where you're going.
Yeah, you know, there's that comment that people have sometimes made, and it's probably unfair, but you can see there's some of the truth in it, that essentially psychedelics are wasted on the young. You know, that young people oftentimes use them and enjoy it and have a great time, but that to the extent that these things offer great benefit, and especially with things like MDMA, where there's typically a limited number of effective uses,
yeah,
you know, they're better to sort of use as a helpful tool and aid as one ages and as one deals with tough situations in life.
That's probably true. I think if you give a tool of this kind, I think of them as spiritual tools. Sasha's the scientist, so he would express it differently. But if you give a tool of this kind, or any like any psychedelic, out to the population at large, which is what happens when you schedule these things,
mm-hmm,
most people aren't ready to use them the way they really need to be used. So it is a waste. But on the other hand, I really want to say something about young people who take a lot of different drugs at the same time, and who keep you know, getting stoned or getting themselves out of their normal reality If they're doing too much of that, then there is a serious possibility that they are unconsciously trying to kill themselves, destroy themselves.
Yeah. Escape some way.
Yeah.
Teenagers go through a lot of very difficult experiences, and sometimes they need to know that they should go to an adult, not necessarily a parent, if the parents are the trouble. And say, you know, please help me, something's wrong.
Yeah, I'm going to interrupt for a second, just for those of you who have tuned in the last 15 minutes or so. This is Ethan Nadelman. I'm the director of the Drug Policy Alliance, which is the country's leading organization promoting alternatives to the war on drugs. And I'm delighted to have as my guest today, Sasha and Ann Shulgin. I should say to those of you who are on that, you know, Drug Policy Alliance, we are a membership organization. We have about 30,000 members right now. We're trying to build this into a powerful national organization, and we're dependent to keep going on your contribution. So if you're not yet a member, or even if you already are, please consider making a donation today to support our work. If you want to ask a question, you can do so by typing it on the bottom right of the auditorium page. Now, Sasha, you know, one of the things that I don't think has been a particular focus of yours, but it's been a lot, it keeps popping up in the news, and it has all sorts of interest, is the drug Ibogaine. Right, that people who are addicted to heroin, cocaine, alcohol, what have you, take Ibogaine, and you know, this powerful hallucinogen, typically not a very pleasurable experience, and come out of it, and when they come out of it, they seem to have entirely lost their taste for whatever it was they were addicted to beforehand, often for days, weeks, and even months, and in some cases even for years. Now, do you have any insight into this? I mean, is it like the LSD thing where people get a sudden insight? Is there something happening to people's bodies during this experience?
Well,
what do you think?
My personal experience with Ibogaine has not been at the monster levels they use in treating people who are addicted. I have lower levels, and I found it to be a very harsh and a very demanding, and to me a very unpleasant experience. Mm-hmm. I wonder if the addiction thing, they're taking much higher levels. And of course, the clinical work is going, I think, totally outside the country now, taking much higher levels and are being really delved into with a hammer and tongs. They are not life-threatened, but they feel that this is a message that they have got to listen to, and they do listen to it. And the two or three people I know who've done clinical studies in this area abroad have said there have been a cases of absolute dropping, or at least for a period of time dropping, the addiction compulsion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, is there anything else among the substances that you've investigated that seems to resemble this or have these properties?
I have heard some of the same sort of responses with the salve divinorum, the mm-hmm. salvinorin, in mm-hmm. which it gets to you. Also, I've heard this mentioned about ketamine.
Mm-hmm.
It gets to you, and it gets your attention, and forces you to look at yourself. The difficulty with the ketamine is itself is an addicting material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so you may replace one problem with another.
Mm-hmm.
But the harshness, the attention demanding of Ibogaine is so great that mm-hmm. it's not a habit you fall into at all.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's another question, Sasha, for you, which is, you know, in all your research over the decades, and you look at the various substances you either invented or discovered, which are the ones which loom largest for you as being the most interesting, either because of the ways they got out there into the culture and were used, or because of what you personally found about them?
Well, to a large measure, I try to keep from developing habits and likes too much,
mm-hmm.
because I want to keep my liver and my head clear
uh-huh.
for new materials. I am very, very fond of 2CB. I think it was a very excellent material. It is now illegal.
And what was it that you liked about 2CB? There's one of the fellow questions. Steve Anker asked this question. What's your favorite one? And as you say, you know.
One of the things I like very much about 2CB is that you, at lower levels, can see, I call it the museum level. You can go to a museum and see the reason that the painter painted what he painted, and yet not alert the guards to the fact that someone is looking at the paint fairly closely and maybe acting a little strangely.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it is a short-lived material, and it is an extremely, it enhances eroticism very much.
Oh, it enhances all the senses.
All the senses, visual, interpretive, erotic. Yes.
But it doesn't have quite that sort of heartwarming feeling that MDMA does.
No, it's not. A little bit of a pushy psychedelic in its own way. Also, it has a negative aspect in that it has a very steep response curve.
Mm-hmm.
With many materials, you take half again the amount and you get a little bit more effect.
Right.
With UCB, you must go up very, very slowly.
Right. So 20 milligrams, you can take a walk around the museum. At 30 milligrams, you better be locked up somewhere.
I would even drop the museum down to more like 10 or 12
milligrams. 10 or 12. Okay, yeah. Well, that's very useful to know for those of you out there who are curious about these things. What about, apart from 2CB, are there other ones that have been really interesting?
My main interest is not in developing, as I mentioned, developing patterns of usage of these materials, but letting them be discovered and finding out what they do, getting them through our little research group, and then getting onto new materials.
Mm-hmm.
So in essence, I avoid the idea of perpetual usage of an interesting compound.
Mm-hmm.
If I were really to pursue that, I think one of the very first drugs I ever took and introduced me to the entire world was mescaline.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm going to say that.
And mescaline is really, to me, probably because it was my first introduction, but to me it's a really remarkable material.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a question here from Tor Larson. It says, I read an article that you created a drugs that alter hearing. Could you explain how they work and what that was like?
There is one drug. It was diisopropyltryptamine, DIPT, that at reasonable levels, I expected it to be psychedelic. And what it is, the radio, music on the radio was totally out of tune.
Mm-hmm.
And I pursued it a little bit from that point of view. It causes distortion of sound. But as other people have told me, and I've gone a little bit more myself, the voices are also distorted, but it is at higher level psychedelic if you can tolerate people speaking badly and radios not being played.
Mm-hmm.
But it is an example of an auditory, which is a rare thing, an auditory distortion, and I think the only one that at low levels is only auditory change.
Mm-hmm. And the scariest experience?
Oh, gosh.
Oh, Lordy. I'm trying to remember which one is the one that I found. It was beautiful in the sense I went into a bliss state. I call it a plus four state,
mm-hmm.
which is not just more intense, but it's an entirely different character of state. But I discovered after a period of an hour or two in this bliss condition, I wondered if I could ever get out of it. And I began thinking, what would be the consequences of being perpetually in a bliss state? And I was a little concerned. It finally dropped away into a normal psychedelic effect.
Yeah.
Well,
and
that sort of thing can happen with any psychedelic drug you take. And it usually will happen once, and then it won't happen again.
That's right. It is not the drug. It is the drug and where you are, the set and setting, the situation of that day.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think some of our listeners will be familiar with the whole notion of drug set and setting, which I think was a term that was first coined by Timothy Leary in the early 60s, and then Andrew Weil sort of took it to the next level in his book, The Natural Mind, and then Norman Zinberg, the Harvard Medical School professor, actually wrote a book called Drug Set and Setting in the 1970s based upon his research, and basically made the argument, as you're saying right here, that if you want to understand the drug experience, you have to look not just at the drug and its specific chemistry and how it's taken into the body, but also the set, which is what do you think it's going to do, and the setting, which is what does your broader cultural society tell you about this drug.
It is a very necessary combination of things because you never can have the same experience twice, and the experience is different because of these two things, what you are hoping to find and where you happen to be when you are looking for it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the most miserable experiences I ever read about was, I think it was in the 60s or 70s, where researchers put the clients they wanted to introduce to a psychedelic drug, put them into a hospital room, and had people in white hospital coats around them. There was no exposure to nature at all. There were no pictures on the wall. There was no music. And invariably, the client came out swearing he would never take another drug like that again. The entire thing was sterile. All the surroundings were sterile. And, of course, the experience was negative.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we've learned not to do that.
Some of the early studies in the use of LSD in the treatment of alcoholism was exactly this way.
Yeah.
They just got these people so smashed and stoned that they did not address their alcoholism problem. They just tried to get out of the locked medical room they were in.
Yeah, no, I think it's oftentimes when people are thinking about doing these powerful psychedelics for the first time, and the best advice to them really is, you know, always make sure that you're doing it both with people who are experienced and who you can trust, preferably using materials that you know have been used by other people who have used materials in the same batch before, that you're in a safe and comfortable environment, and that you know that there are people who can take care of you or watch out for you if the trip goes in the wrong direction.
We have a phrase, be sure you have a good babysitter.
Yes.
Someone who is not stoned, who is with you and is familiar with the effects of the material and can physically or mentally, verbally guide you around any obstacle you run into.
Yeah.
And also preferably near a garden or plants. That really is important.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
And also your choice of music.
Mm-hmm.
These things help open those doors within your psyche.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, it goes to that issue also that that folks have talked about in the past, which is that when you look at more traditional societies that have found ways to integrate these substances, whether it's ayahuasca or peyote or a range of others, and the thing that's sort of sadly lacking in contemporary Western society, and especially American society, is anybody who plays the role of the shaman, the responsible shaman, the leader, the person who can help people and guide people. You know, not even so much in the use of these things, but in deriving the greatest benefit and the safest ways to use these things. I mean, do you see anything on the horizon that looks like it's emerging? I mean, one hears, you know, there is a sort of underground, quote-unquote, of people who seem to be moving forward in this around the world, but what can you say about that?
Well, while these drugs are illegal, you can't develop a shamanic class, if you want to put it that way, out in the open. It is very much present underground.
Mm-hmm.
But what we need is more of an emphasis on that kind of guidance in the society. But you first have to stop illegalizing everything that has to do with this sort of experience.
You know, this does sort of bridge into a discussion of another drug, which is ayahuasca. And it's interesting, I think, for a few reasons. One is, I found it interesting how many people the three of us know, who are very experienced in taking the psychedelics, many of whom will describe ayahuasca, for one reason or another, as the queen of all the substances they've ever tried. They see it as having some special quality. I mean, obviously, the set and setting are part of that. And the second factor about it is these cases that have worked their way through the federal court in New Mexico. Now, the Court of Appeals actually upholding the First Amendment free exercise of religion right to use these substances for people who are members of the church.
But the government's fighting that, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Which is really extraordinary. No, I guess it isn't extraordinary.
Well, an interesting twist on the ayahuasca is its primary target of the government is because it contains DMT.
Mm-hmm.
But I got a sample of material that was called Pharmawaska from Holland, and I analyzed it, and it was a mixture of 5-methoxy-DMT and an monoamine oxidase inhibitor. So it had the same effects of ayahuasca, and it contained no illegal drug.
Oh, is that right?
So this may be a strategy that might be followed. On the other hand, if it is followed, you merely encourage, as things are now, the federal government to extend the federal drug law and convert things that are considered perhaps controlled substance analogs into scheduled drugs.
Well, right. I mean, Sasha, I remember when you and I first met in the late 1980s, one of the things I think that it had a profound impact on you was the passing of the Federal Controlled Substances Analogs Act, which I think, as I recall, you were a little fearful was going to land up criminalizing huge areas of research that you were engaged in.
Well, the objection I have to the analog bill is still in that bill. It is the very divisive and almost intentionally vague wording of how you define an analog. It's not an analog, it's a controlled substance analog. And the wording is, if something has an effect or a structure or is intended to have the effect of that is substantially similar to a Schedule I drug, it can be used as a target in court for accusing you of violating the law. And I don't know the meaning of substantially similar. I know what's meant by stochastic the same, and I know what's meant by similar.
Mm-hmm.
But every time each of the times I've had occasion to be an expert in a court, and the person asked me, is this stochastic similar to that? I'd turn to the judge and say, Your Honor, I don't understand the question.
Mm-hmm.
And the prosecutor cannot rephrase the question because then he steps away from this little sliminess of the law that says substantially similar.
Mm-hmm.
This I consider a very, very unfortunate law that is intentionally...
Are there many people being prosecuted under that, do you know?
There are quite a few, especially since the collapsing of the websites that are selling materials for probably human use that are not illegal.
Mm-hmm.
There was Operation Trip or Act Trip recently, in which the DEA brought down about four or five of these, and these people are being charged with the selling of analog drugs.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to interrupt for a second. Once again, for our listeners, my name is Ethan Nadelman. I'm the director of the Drug Policy Alliance, which is really the leading organization in the country of people who think the war on drugs is doing more harm than good. We are a membership organization, so if you are a member or if you're not, please consider making a donation today or tomorrow to help support what we're doing. You know, we're working on trying to reduce the spread of AIDS through clean needle programs. We're trying to work on alternatives to incarceration. We're working on trying to expand the province of cognitive liberty. And I want to just take up that issue now in this last quarter of our show with Sasha and Ann Shulgin, the really beautiful and wonderful psychedelic pioneers. You know, there is this question. I mean, somebody asked here, I think it was Jeff, doesn't have his last name, are you an advocate for cognitive rights, or do you simply support the use of psychedelics in a medical setting? Ann, Sasha, yeah?
I'm adamantly in favor of cognitive rights. I think one of our greatest liberties is our freedom of thought. And this, unfortunately, is undergoing challenges not only in the medical but in the political area right now. I believe that the
Center for Cognitive Liberties.
I think they are a superb group working in a very, very necessary direction that you must be free to be able to think as you wish, and I very strongly believe that.
But I can't understand how anyone brought up. I'm sorry, Sasha's just getting over a bad cold.
I'm trying to stay away from the phone when I clear my throat.
I cannot believe that anyone who has found out that there is a Constitution and a Bill of Rights and has any idea of what the founders of this country really stood for, I don't see how they can be against. An adult searching to find out about his own mind. It's the equivalent of a woman's right to choose. Every woman has the right to say what can or cannot be done with her body. And I think every human being has the right to decide what can or cannot be done with his or her mind.
And the idea is almost like denying a person the right of education.
Yeah.
Learning. I mean, the education itself, it makes irreversible changes in the brain. People who go to college do not come out the same way they went in.
Well, you hope they didn't.
I hope not.
Yeah, no, I mean, actually, that is the core principle of the Drug Policy Alliance, and really, in many respects, the entire growing drug policy reform movement, which is that people should not be punished simply for what they put into their bodies if they don't hurt anybody else.
I totally agree. You have to be totally free to do as you wish. You're giving drugs to people against their wishes or to people who are too young to be able to rally with the changes, or to people they're driving under the influence of drugs, yes.
Yeah.
Other than that, these restrictions, there should be no law against the use of drugs.
Yeah, you know, if you think about it, too, from a constitutional perspective, and you look at, you know, one of the things that makes the United States most special, historically and even today, has been the First Amendment. It's been the First Amendment freedoms of speech, press, religion, and assembly.
Right.
And if you think about it, all of those freedoms, those core freedoms, which were so revolutionary to be articulated in such a coherent way in a nation's constitution 200-odd years ago, they're all based upon an underlying assumption, which is the assumption that people people have freedom of consciousness.
Yes.
And I think what we're talking about here is whether or not people are going to have freedom of consciousness. That the drugs, and especially with regard to the drugs we're talking about, these drugs, the psychedelics, MDMA, the ones that really have a really long and established history, and even in some cases scientifically established history, of helping people open up their consciousness, whether it's an intellectual consciousness or an emotional awareness, or whether it's even opening up to God or to a higher power, that these are powerful tools for doing this thing. And for the government or any other powerful entity to deprive people of that basic freedom is something that we need to fight against. And I think if, in fact, we can find a way to enshrine that principle, expand that principle of freedom into the national political culture and ultimately into the Constitution, that will do more than anything to end and to gut the war on drugs.
Yeah.
Another point of the Constitution that is often ignored is not the First, but the Tenth Amendment.
Yes.
That says that anything that is not covered in the Constitution or in the First Nine Amendments should revert to the state and or to the people. And I was talking with a person, Thomas Soss, who's quite a superb writer in his own way, and I was asking him about his arguments on legalization of drugs, and he said with his heavy Hungarian accent, "What do you mean legalize? You know, decriminalize. What do you mean decriminalize? What the word you're looking for is repeal." And the idea of following the Tenth Amendment and repeal the federal drug law, it has no business being there because it's not in the Constitution, and let the states write their own drug laws.
Mm-hmm.
It would be a very good move.
Yeah, I mean, Soss wrote that classic book, Ceremonial Chemistry, many years ago, in which he compared the persecution of drug users and addicts and quote-unquote pushers to the persecution of witches and Jews and other demonized minorities throughout history. And I think he made a very powerful point in that regard.
What people should realize is that we have evidence going back 50,000 years to the great caves where all of us lived for a very long time, evidence of the use of visionary plants. This is something that all human beings do. In some cultures, it was only the shamans or the authority figures who were allowed to use them. In other cultures, everybody was allowed to use them. They have been used for spiritual, religious purposes. And the idea that we are to stop this kind of pursuit of knowledge and this kind of spiritual practice is ridiculous. It makes no sense.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I remember, obviously we all knew Terence McKenna, who was just a brilliant and captivating speaker and colorful writer and provocative thinker. And he had some ideas about the roles that some of these substances have played in human evolution.
Yeah.
I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
interesting theories. I don't think they can ever be disproven.
Well, I told him of an interesting paper that the work was done in Ohio some years ago, I think it was the Battelle Institute, in which a researcher was studying people's ability to read under control of themselves and then under the influence of psilocybin. And he had a way of eclipsing 5 or 10 or 15 or 20% of the print. And how much could he eclipse and the person not be able to know what he's reading? If it was totally uneclipsed, he'd read normally. But if you took away some of the viewing, the bottoms or the tops of the letters, at a certain point, you could not make sense out of what you're reading. Under the influence of psilocybin, you could take away twice as much and still know what you're reading. And so Terence made the argument, this is why people maybe used mushrooms, and they went up in the trees, and they had this better understanding of a limited amount of clue, and therefore they know where to go to get the night's dinner. They're the animals to be found.
Right.
And they could see better than the people who did not use the mushrooms, and hence this may have been an evolutionary plus for the use of mushrooms.
Yeah.
I think we're talking about very early man.
Very early men who go up trees to find out where the dinner is.
Right? Yeah, right. Yeah. No, I guess so. You know, you mentioned before we went on online here that you might be seeing Albert Hoffman soon. And you know, he's the one who, you know, discovered or invented LSD 60 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and LSD has loomed large in the whole history of psychedelics. The question is there something distinctive about it? I mean, was it just that it happened to become the letters and the catchiness and Leary and all this sort of stuff, or was it, could it just as easily, if LSD had never emerged, might mushrooms or, you know, psilocybin or something else just as easily have played that role?
I think very, very much so. Actually, you must not forget that Hoffman is also the person who worked out the structure of psilocybin. No, I think that when the time is right, the agent that's actually employed is, I think, a secondary.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, there's a couple of questions about you, Sashi, here. The first one is, do you originate from Russia?
No, I'm born in Berkeley, California.
Uh-huh. And then the next one is, did you know that your books, T-Call and P-Call, were banned there?
I knew they were banned there, and yet I was sent a copy of a translation of the first half of P-Call that had been translated into Russian and was being sold in Russia. Mm-hmm. They took out the synthetic chemistry part, but they kept in the sex and drugs half. And also, I recently sent a copy to a person in southern Russia of both P-Call and T-Call as a gift, and had return receipt requested, and I got the return receipt. So they will be banned, but they're still going.
Okay, and here's another question that I think you guys wrote in the book at times, that you had a relationship with some folks who worked at the DEA, although obviously the DEA was the ones that raided your home at some point with state authorities. But what was the relationship with the guys at the DEA?
I've heard people say that I was employed by them. I have never been employed by them.
Mm-hmm.
My relationship with them was the fact I knew a number of chemists who were good chemists, and these are friendships. And I would often go, not often, but occasionally go and give a seminar at the DEA office in San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
But I've never worked for them, and I do not have. Unfortunately, I now cannot even communicate with my friends because they have blocked communication.
Yeah, no, it does seem like things have become more and more rigid in the dividing lines. You know, just last Wednesday, Congressman Souder from Indiana held a very, very hostile hearing about drug policy reform and harm reduction, in which he attacked George Soros and, you know, my organization, the Drug Policy Alliance. And you just see these horrible pressures. I mean, it just seems like a bit of a retrograde effort to try to shut down any types of real communication interaction. And it's amazing that you keep doing what you're doing in the face of all this. Now, there's one last question here, which is somebody just wrote in for both of you, Anne and Sasha. So what more do you still want to do, in the many years you still have ahead of you? Do you have any grand goal or grand plan?
Well, my grand goal is just doing what I'm doing, namely taking the little bit of art I have in knowing where to look to create new materials, not because I'm after making new psychedelics, because I'm very interested in that, but I'm also even more interested in developing tools that can be used to determine why the mind functions as it is. These materials are potentially research tools that will someday in the future be used for answering questions about the mental process.
And I think both of us intend to write as long as we can hold that little keyboard in our hands. It's most important, I think, to put what we know and what we felt and experienced down on paper so that somebody somewhere may find it useful.
Uh-huh.
Both of us are going to continue doing that.
So what's the current writing project?
Well, I'm right in the middle of a psychedelic index book like the Merck Index, but I want to get it out of the way. It's going to be a monster. And we want to get back to the P-Cow, T-Cow series, and go, one more book in that series, probably call it the third book.
the third book. And as I understand it, the book's been selling quite well. You sold, was it tens of thousands of copies of...
The P-Cow's up around 50,000.
That's fantastic.
Well, I think the article in the New York Times said something about P-Cow 41,000 at the time, and that this was exceptional, which is nice to know. I didn't realize it was exceptional, but we're happy that people are finding it useful and interesting.
Yeah. Well, listen, I just want to say, for those of you who have tuned in and been listening, this is Ethan Nadelman, Director of the Drug Policy Alliance. I hope you've enjoyed this chat with Sasha and Anne. I do hope that you will choose to support the Drug Policy Alliance in our work. We really can't do what we do without your help. Sasha, Anne, I'm incredibly grateful for your taking this hour to have this chat with me and to have everyone listening to our conversation. I love you guys. I think you're just doing amazing, amazing work, and I think so many many people just listening to this can understand why you're heroes to literally hundreds of thousands of people all around the world. So
we found this very enjoyable hour. Thank you, Ethan.
Thank you, Ethan, so much.
Yeah. Okay, guys, take care.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye.